We'll call the meeting to order. We don't quite have a quorum yet, but I thought we could start with the testimony on House File 633, and as soon as we do get a quorum, we'll pick up the minutes and move Representative Sertich's bill. House File 633 is Sertich bill for health plan coverage for hearing aids regulated. Representative Sertich, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Great to be here. Members, House File 33 deals with insurance coverage of hearing aids. And I just want to tell you a brief story on why I'm carrying this bill and why it's before you today, and then I'll hand it over to expert testimony on the details of the bill. Members, I had a constituent call me from Chisholm, who I know well and serves in the volunteer fire department, and he told me a situation that happened to his young son. He said, I've been meaning to call you for about a year. I'm frustrated, and you seem like the right person to talk to. He told me about his son who was born in Hibbing, had complications with his birth and was flown to Duluth immediately. And found out later that he had some hearing concerns and was directed to a law that is on the books. If you look at the bill, insurance companies provide for hearing aids for children under 18 years of age if they if it's due to functional congenital malformation of the ears. This family, this young child, they did not test. Generally that test happens right after birth. As I said, this young child was flown because of other complications, so they were unable to test this child for this issue. And so they had to go round and round with the insurance company. The insurance company did not cover because they said they could not prove this condition. So he was frustrated. We set him along a path working with the Attorney General to work with the insurance company. They're in the process of doing so. But as I spoke to this family further, I said, do you want me to do anything else? He said, yes. Would you please introduce a bill and move forward? Because I don't think we should delineate between hearing conditions of young children based on this condition or other conditions of hearing loss. I think it's good and appropriate that we have something that's consistent across the board on this issue. And so that's why we're before us today. It stemmed with an individual constituent, but I don't believe in solving problems for individual constituents. This will affect a whole group of young Minnesotans and better their lives.
Thank you, Representative Sertich. And with the quorum now present, the chair will move House File 633 be recommended pass and refer to the General Register. I see you're joined by a handsome fellow, probably from your district, I hope.
No.
Oh, well, sorry, then we're not going to hear from you unless you don't. Welcome to the committee. You can just identify yourself for us.
It's good to be here. My name is Carl White. I am the director of the National Center for Hearing Assessment and Management, as located in Logan, Utah, and have been asked to come to talk about a number of issues that are before the legislature related to early identification of hearing loss. I'll be very brief. Many of you probably don't realize that congenital hearing loss is the most frequent birth defect in America. It affects about 3 children per 1,000, but there are at least triple that many children who, as the constituent that was just described to you, children will develop hearing loss in the early years of life before they start going to school. If hearing loss is not identified early, it can have devastating effects for the child and for their family. They will not develop language normally. They'll lag behind in terms of cognitive and social skills. It's one example of that. The average deaf adult in this country who was born before we had the ability to detect hearing loss early reads at about the third or fourth grade level. So in spite of the fact that we're spending tens of thousands of dollars per person per year, they have, on average, difficulty catching up, or it's almost impossible to catch up. What's wonderful is in the last 15 to 20 years, there's been new technology developed that were able to identify children earlier. Digital hearing aids, cochlear implants, and other intervention programs make it possible to provide effective intervention for these children. And if we intervene early, then they will achieve at grade level for the vast majority of them by the time that they enter school, thus saving the educational system hundreds of thousands of dollars, but more importantly, making it possible for them to interact with their families. Now, what's key about that is to make sure that from the time that they're identified that they have auditory input. And for the majority of these children with congenital hearing loss or late onset hearing loss, that means high quality hearing aids. And those hearing aids are not now available to many children, and because of that, they're not able to make the kinds of progress that we're talking about here, and down the road end up costing society much more money than the hearing aids would have cost in the first place. So I noticed that many of you are wearing glasses, and probably others of you are wearing contact lenses. Think of how hard it would be to get along without those, if someone just took them away. Hearing loss is much more serious than that, because it cuts you off from interaction with everybody around you. And what this bill is all about is making sure that all children have access to hearing aids so they can develop the skills, the communication skills, the language skills, and ultimately be successful in life. So I hope that you will consider this bill very favorably. I think it can have tremendous impact on the lives of children and families. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that desires to be heard, Representative Sir? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Patty Morelli Teachout, and I am the mother of this 8-year-old child right here. His name is William, and he was born with a congenital malformation causing a hearing loss. He and I were here. I'll set that there so you can see. He and I were here 4 years ago in connection with the bill that was passed requiring insurance companies to cover hearing aids for children born with hearing loss. And since that time, I have been appointed to the Minnesota Commission Serving the Deaf and Hard of Hearing People, and also been contacted by many, many parents and many audiologists throughout the state of Minnesota that are very frustrated over the current bill as it stands right now. Many families are feeling frustrated because they're feeling like their children are being left out because their children were not born with hearing loss, but they acquired the loss after birth, thus they don't qualify for the bill as it stands. My son, Will, he's in third grade right now, and he's been in speech therapy twice a week for the past 5 years. He did not receive his first set of hearing aids until he was 3 years old, and as a result, he missed out on a great deal of the early formation, language formation that happened between birth and 3 years old. He, however, at the cost of early ed and special ed dollars, just this past year, he surpassed his peer group academically, so it was a huge plus for us, but again, it cost the state education dollars and special ed dollars a lot because of the 5 years of speech therapy he's been in, and he's still in speech therapy, so it's still an ongoing issue. If he would have got fitted with aids early on at birth, he did not get tested at birth because the hospital he was in did not require a testing, therefore he was missed. But if he had been tested at birth, been aided at birth, and then got into the system early on, it would have significantly reduce the amount of money that the state is having to spend on his speech and language formation at this time. So I think we do a great job with our kids. I think we can do an even better job with our kids. I think we can include all the kids, whether they're born with a loss or they acquire the loss under this bill. So that's what I'm here to ask you to support. So
thank you. Representative Sertich, is there anyone else that you have to be heard from?
Mr. Chair, that's all I have.
Okay. Is there any ogres in the audience that desire to speak in opposition to this nice bill?
Does anybody want to see my son's picture again?
The only comment that I would make, Representative Sertich, as we renew our motion to pass the bill and refer it now onto the floor, is one I'm sure you're well aware of, and it's with regard to the ongoing or increasing mandates, and I know there's mandate reviews and all of that. And just for this committee's sake, we need to keep that in mind as we move bills. This is an important bill. I expect it to move forward. I wish you the very best with it, but in the larger scheme of things, we also have to make sure that we're cognizant, careful about the overarching number and collection of mandates that are out there. With that, are there any other comments or questions for Representative Sertich or his two very articulate witnesses? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, motion carries. Thank you, Representative Sertich. Mr. Wyatt, Ms. Teachout, we appreciate your comments today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate it.
With that, Representative Simpson moves the minutes of the March 1st, 2007 Commerce and Labor Committee meeting. Are there comments, questions with respect to that? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That motion carries. Next up is House File 772, Representative Kamar's bill with regard to aircraft insurance minimum liability requirements and aircraft insurance made not voidable retroactively. Representative Kamar, welcome to the committee. Chair moves House File 772 be recommended passed and we refer to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. Representative Kamar, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You should have a delete all amendments, and I'm not sure which delete all you have.
H 772 delete number one, DE1 amendment, and Chair would move. I assume that would shape it up into the shape that the author wants, or is there more commentary?
I need to make an oral amendment to the amendment if I can.
Where would you change it, Representative Paymar?
On page 1, line 18, after the word no, insert fraud or. So it should read, no statement by the insured or on the insured's behalf, and no fraud or violation of the policy defeats or voids the policy, is the way it's supposed to read.
Okay.
just repeat that, Mr. Chair.
I'd be happy to. For purposes of, and I would move that oral amendment as part of the DE1. It would be on line 1.18 after the second no, would insert the words fraud or before the word violation.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
That's moved. Is there, then that puts it in the shape that you'd like to proceed, Representative Paymar?
Yes, it is.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. That's incorporated. Representative Paymar, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. First, House File 772 seeks to raise the minimum amount of insurance required to fly an airplane. Second, it seeks to clarify the state's position regarding injuries to innocent third parties as a result of an aviation accident. The bill raises the minimum amounts of insurance a pilot must carry in order to fly. The minimums have not been addressed since 1976. The rate currently stands at $25,000 per passenger seat liability, $25,000 for bodily injury or death to each non-passenger, and $50,000 per occurrence for bodily injury or death to non-passengers in any one incident. This bill raises the minimum to $100,000, $100,000, and $300,000, respectively. Secondly, the bill has language regarding third-party liability. It clarifies the duties and obligations of the insured. It simply clarifies that any avoidance for fraud provision must make an exception so as not to apply to liability coverage. The bill also provides against the ability of insureds and insurers from agreeing to settlement and then retroactively canceling the policy so the insured third party does not have recourse against the insurer. Members, this bill came from an incident that happened in 2003 where there was a plane crash in Grand Marais, Minnesota. The pilot, Charlie Erickson, and passenger, Catherine Pearson, died in that crash. The two girls, Grace, then 4 years old, and Lily, then 3 years old, survived the crash. Catherine, Grace, and Lily all lived in Duluth at the time of the crash. The girls had extensive medical injuries, with Grace spending approximately 3 weeks and Lily spending 8 weeks in various hospitals. When the girls emerged from the hospitals and the medical bills started arriving, their family was informed that the airline insurance company was denying coverage. This started more than 3 years of litigation between the family and the insurance company. Finally, after more than 3 years, the parties entered into a settlement. By passing this bill, we assure that innocent third parties like the Pearsons would not have to go through such an ordeal. We do this by raising the minimum amounts of insurance that pilots must carry, and we codify the existing department procedure regarding liability coverage. I have with me this afternoon Toby Pearson, the father of Grace and Lily, and the widower of Catherine Pearson, and John Dornick, the attorney who represented the family in the litigation. So if they could provide some brief testimony, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Paymar. Who do you want to go with first, Mr. Pearson?
Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair, members.
Welcome to the committee.
My name is Toby Pearson. I'm the father of Grace and Lily Pearson and was married to Catherine Pearson at the time of the crash. I'm here to show support for the bill that is before you and urge your support. There are two important aspects of the bill. First, increasing the minimums, and second, taking the Commerce Department procedure and putting it into statute. First, the minimums.
In our case, the medical bills accumulated and the economic and emotional losses for our family far outweighed the insurance minimums, where they are and where we are moving them. However, I realize in my conversations with some of the pilots that we cannot price pilots out of insurance, and the insurance industry was uncomfortable with moving it as far as I wanted to move it. But we agreed to the numbers of 100, 100, and 300. So these numbers represent a compromise with pilots and the insurance industry. The second part of the bill is to assure future injured third parties do not have to experience what I went through in trying to recover. I experienced the highs and lows of 3 years of litigation, hearings, mediations, before finally arriving at a settlement. In that time, I had to relocate my family, change jobs, pay all the medical bills, change the schools that Grace and Lily attended, and leave the very supportive community and friends and family in the city of Duluth. Generally, I had to change every aspect of my life and the lives of my children. By assuring that there is no avoidance for fraud as it pertains to liability coverage and putting the Commerce Department procedure into statute, no other family will have to experience what I experienced for over 3 years of negotiation and litigation. It's for that reason that I urge your support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. And we, I think I speak for everybody on the committee. We certainly sympathize with your loss and what you've been through over the last several years. Representative Paymar, is Mr. Dornick also going to testify with respect to the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm primarily here, Mr. Chair, to answer any questions. I might point out that as far as the liability limits provision is concerned, there rarely, if ever, is an aviation incident in which the injuries that befall the victims of that crash don't exceed $100,000. Most of the time, as I'm sure all of you know, it results in death or injury to the passengers in the aircraft and those innocent bystanders on the ground. And this, of course, also provides coverage to those folks. The other provision, the avoidance for fraud provision, mirrors the Minnesota No Fault Act. I think it's 65B, subdivision 3A. Has language just like this as it applies to automobiles. So it mirrors that. Our state has recognized that in automobile litigation, the avoidance for fraud provision does not provide to liability claims, and this bill would just really mirror that as it applies to aviation accidents.
Thank you, Mr. Dornick. Representative Paymar, anybody else who wants to testify in support of the bill that you're aware of?
That's all I have.
Okay. Is there anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to this bill? I know we've got Ms. Turner from Travelers. Ms. Turner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bev Turner. I'm with Travelers Insurance Companies. Thank you for the opportunity to be heard today. First, I would like to extend my condolences to the Pearson family for their very tragic loss. And I also want to say I appreciate Mr. Pearson's willingness to sit down with us to discuss on this very important issue, and we've come a long way from where the bill started today and on a successful fruit of those talks. However, I have to say that we still have some concerns about the bill. We agree with the liability limits, and we have agreed with the first clause of the amendment you have before you. The concern still arises over Clause 2 of the bill, of the amendment, lines 18 and 19. And I want to give you a little bit about a background about this particular type of insurance coverage. There are not many carriers out there who actually sell this product, and they're not well known across the board. It's not your household names that sell this type of product. They are special insurance aviation companies for the whole part that do this, with the exception, I think, AIG is a large carrier. Travelers Insurance Company, the company that I work for, we currently do not sell this product in the United States. We do sell it outside of the country, but we are in the process right now of developing a product for small aircraft that can be sold in this country. And so I'm speaking from a carrier that's looking to come into a potential market. And that's where I'm going to address my concerns with this. Basically, what the bill does, it may preclude us from actually coming into the Minnesota market because it takes away our defenses, what are called coverage defenses that you have in a policy, an insurance policy. So I'll give you some examples in this particular type of situation, what it could do. If, say, a pilot, and I know I'm being rather extreme, but I just want to kind of give you some examples. Say the pilot allowed their 10-year-old child to pilot the plane and it crashed, we would have to pay we wouldn't have a defense coverage against that. Say the plane was used to haul illegal drugs, somebody's trafficking in illegal drugs, we believe we would potentially have to pay for that as well. Or say the aircraft certificate was pulled from the plane and the pilot piloted it anyway and got into an accident, again, we would have to pay, so we wouldn't have those coverage defenses. And that kind of coverage defenses, they help us to be able to ascertain the risk on a policy and underwrite it appropriately. When that's taken away, it increases the exposure we have. So, of course, the price goes up, or if we can't price the exposure, then we won't sell the product. The other aspect to this is on the fraud issue. And the FAA is actually the regulator for pilots. They license the pilots and check them out on the planes before they can fly them. They actually maintain the database for gathering information about accidents, but it's not a sufficient database in order for us to underwrite the policy, which means it's not an adequate database for us to use to determine the pilot's whether or not we should write the coverage or not, or the premium to charge. Their accident database, you can pull up by date of the accident, but it's not cross-referenced to the pilot. And some accidents are never reported. It depends on the severity of the accident, whether it actually the FAA even has the data on it. So some of those pieces are missing. It is an insufficient database. So we really have to rely on the pilot's application when they certify that all of the things, their history, where they're going to use the plane, their medical history, we have to rely on that certification in order to appropriately figure out whether or not to deny coverage, approve it, and where to price the premium for that product. So from our perspective, this bill takes away those defenses and also our ability to accurately underwrite the product going forward. And I want to say we have worked with Mr. Pearson, the proponent of the bill, understand or can't even understand the loss and the tragedy that his family underwent. But we want to make sure at the other side that the pilots actually have affordable insurance and that they have access to an insurance market so that this product can be still made available. And that's, I think, what I know Mr. Pearson has no interest in shutting that down in the state, and neither do we. So we have a common interest of trying to figure out where we can go from here, but believe that the bill still needs some work. Thank you, and I'd be more than happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Turner. And I think, let me ask, is there anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to this item? Seeing none, are there questions, comments? And I'll certainly give the final word to the author as well. So be an opportunity. Representative De La Forest.
Mr. Chairman, a question for Ms. Turner. You know, regarding the concern you have with the language starting on line 18 of the DE amendment, are there other, you know, I confess at the outset, I don't know as much as others who have spent more time in this committee about insurance products that are available in Minnesota or other jurisdictions. Are there other insurance products in Minnesota or other jurisdictions that require the insurance company to execute the contract, even though the applicant or the one who entered into the contract on the other side defrauded the insurance company or violated the policy?
Ms. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative De La Forest, I'm not aware of any. I know this language on the Clause 2, except for the fraud provision, mirrors what is in the auto insurance, the no-fault auto insurance for uninsured and underinsured motorists and the liability provision. But those are significantly lower limits, of course, than what we deal with in aviation. But that fraud provision, and I will be stand corrected if I'm wrong, I don't believe that appears in statute, and nowhere else in the country am I aware on the aviation side that this type of language appears.
Representative LaForce. Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for Ms. Turner. How will this, with this new policy or this new bill, how will this compare us to other states? Are we changing policy compared to other states, or will Minnesota pilots continue to register planes in Minnesota if it's cheaper to do it in North Dakota, or how will we compare with our surrounding states?
Ms. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I can't speak for the industry because I'm only one carrier looking at this as a potential market. I guess I have to reiterate that we would have to evaluate whether we would write in this in Minnesota because of this legislation. We haven't seen anything else like this across the country in the aviation insurance industry. So it's breaking new ground here in the state.
Representative Simpson, anything else?
No.
Representative Paulson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe just to follow up on that then. I mean, do we have any idea what the insurance rates will go up? I mean, the pilot who goes to my church, the small-time pilot, I mean, what are his rates going to go up on his small single-engine or two-engine plane? Any idea at all? I'm just trying to get a handle on this. And can that pilot register their plane in another state and get around the law?
Ms. Turner, are you ready to provide a quote for Mr. Paulson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paulson, I can't provide you a quote, but I can say that this is part of the nut of the issue with this is that we wouldn't know how to price that type of product when we don't know how much exposure we're looking at or what the risk would be. And that's part of the contemplation of whether we actually would come into Minnesota to write the product if you can't price it appropriately or even to deny coverage or approve it because you can't rely on the application anymore.
Representative Paul.
And then, Mr. Chair, the other question, can somebody register their plane in another state and get around the law? I mean, get around the coverage? I mean, if we're quadrupling the rates here, or the coverage, are we going to quadruple the rate and then someone can go to North Dakota, as Representative Simpson had mentioned, and get insurance for someone else and not be covered?
Mr. Chairman, anyone can move their plane, and I'm sure, and house it in another state. I mean, that's a possibility. And the way the language reads, it's basically if you license and register the plane in the state. But I have to qualify that saying I'm not the expert on this. not the one to ask.
But a good issue nonetheless. Is there anyone else that has questions or comments for either Ms. Turner or for the author? Representative Burns?
I just want to follow up with Ms. Turner. On lines 18 and 19, which you talked about, I think I heard you right. You could commit fraud and not have your policy canceled. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burns, that's the way that we read the language to me.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Burns. Any follow-up?
No, thank you.
And I mean, I'm just a simple fellow. I don't necessarily know that that's exactly the. I think that you can cancel the policy, or you can refuse to write the policy. But in the event that there would be an accident, that you would not have the right to, as far as a defense to not paying on the policy, you wouldn't be able to raise the fraud issue. But
Chairman, I guess it would depend how you read defeat. Defeat meaning if you canceled it or.
Fair enough. And are there other questions for Ms. Turner? Otherwise, I'm going to let her get running again. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Turner.
Thank you for your time today.
And just a comment that I wanted to share. I've been, and Mr. Pearson, Ms. Turner, I give everybody great credit and gratitude for your willingness to, they really have done a yeoman's job of trying to work together and figure out language that works. This language that they currently have came somewhat out of the no-fault statute, car insurance statute. And my only concern about it, and I hope that we will pass this bill. It wouldn't be here, actually, if I didn't anticipate passage of the bill. But we have a very competitive, vibrant market for car insurance. I think there's, what, now 63 different folks that write car insurance. My concern about this is whether or not we'd have, I think there's only two or three or four that will write airplane insurance in Minnesota. I want to make sure that the language is such that it will get sold. I've shared that with Mr. Pearson, shared that with Representative Paymar. The bill is going to go on to Chair Mullery's Public Safety and Civil Justice Committee. And I just want to, and I'd be happy to continue to put whatever little effort and hard work that I can put into it as well. But I want to make sure that that something gets done, but it's also a product that will get sold. In the car insurance market, I'm not so concerned because if we lose two or three insurers, we still got 60 left. In the plane insurance business, I want to make sure that we've got a lot of folks that want to participate in Minnesota's airplane insurance. If we pass this and nobody's willing to sell the insurance, we haven't really accomplished anything. So I would hope that we'd keep working at it. Maybe this is the thing that'll work, but I want to make sure that we continue to move that that issue forward and keep meeting with regard to it. Representative Paymar, I always reserve the last couple comments for the author.
If you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chair, I would like Mr. Pearson to respond to some of the questions that were raised by the Travelers Insurance.
Absolutely. Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair, members, I just wanted to clarify a couple things. First of all, the changes that we're seeking would not make changes or are not intended to make changes to the relationship between the insured and the insurance company. As to their defenses against the insured, his or herself, the pilot, they can still argue about whether or not there should be coverage. They can still sue each other over whether or not somebody's paying out for something that they shouldn't be paying over. But as far as an innocent third party who has no way of knowing, who has no way of finding out, and who has absolutely no way of controlling whether or not the plane hits them, crashes, lands on their house, anything in that nature. I mean, we can come up with all the absurd categories that we want in instances, and luckily I've lived one of them. But as to that relationship between the insured and the insurance company, it doesn't affect their ability to argue between themselves. We're simply looking at addressing the relationship with the injured third party who's completely innocent. In my case, it was a 3- and 4-year-old girl. My daughters. The question before you is, should the 3- and 4-year-old girls have to fight against the insurance company to get money, or should that be a relationship between the insured and the insurance company themselves? Who should be fighting that fight? This language seeks to make it, it's the fight between the two parties that originally contracted, leaving the completely innocent injured third parties out of it. The second part is, the language or similar language does exist in statute in the state of Minnesota, 65B.49, 3 subdivision A. That's where we started with the language in the first place. So that language does exist in statute in the state of Minnesota. Finally, I agree. We have been trying to work very hard with the insurance companies. We've been meeting with them, trying to get them. We've agreed on some parts of it. We haven't agreed on all of the parts of it yet. I pledge to continue to sit down with them, talk to them, see if we can find some sort of agreement that works for everybody's interest, and make sure that this can work for all parties. My goal isn't to make sure that, you know, the pilot in your church can't get airplane insurance. My goal is just to make sure that the innocent third parties, in my case, the 3- and 4-year-old girl, don't have to fight against the insurance company to get recovery. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Representative Paymar, you want to try to follow that act?
No, I don't, Mr. Chair. I think you said everything and more, and I would appreciate the committee's support. Hopefully, between now and the next committee stop, we can fix the language that's contentious. So.
Very good, Representative Paymar. Unless there's anything further, Chair would renew his motion that House File 772 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. Seeing no further comments, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you and congratulations. Appreciate your comments this afternoon. Next up is House File 413. This is Representative Lilly's bill with regard to outdoor sports equipment dealers franchise agreements. With manufacturers regulating those, as well as some title requirements and money appropriate. Representative Lilly moves House File 413 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. You sure you want to go there? You'll have to see folks like Mallory and Davy and me again. With that, Representative Lilly, I understand you have a couple of amendments that would shape the bill up into the fashion that you'd like to proceed with it. And I'm assuming that you first moved the A1 amendment. Is that your amendment, Representative Lilly?
Yes, sir.
All right, that amendment is moved. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That is adopted. Then we have the A101 amendment. You desire to move that amendment as well, Representative Lilly?
Is that the written one, Mr. Chair?
That is the handwritten.
Okay.
It should be in front of members.
And a little bit later we could have, Mr. Chair, we could have Mr. Fender.
It is coming around, and why don't
explain
you... But this is also an author's amendment, Representative Lilly?
Yes, sir. It was, Mr. Chair and members, it was through a discussion from both sides of the issue, and it was brought by the other side to try and help improve our bill. So, Mr. Pender can explain it later a little.
Okay, well, for now, since it's an author's amendment and it's been moved, and it shapes the bill up into the fashion you'd like to proceed with it, is there further discussion of that? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, the bill is now in the shape, I believe, Representative Lilly, that you desire to proceed. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a great bill for the smaller businesses in Minnesota, the dealers that are around our state. It's very important to them. What it does is it modifies the relationship that currently exists between the manufacturers and the dealers of ATVs, dirt bikes, and boats and jet skis, all those fun things that are going on in Minnesota. So what we're trying to do here with this bill is match some of the relationships that exist currently in other states, our neighboring states, Wisconsin, or at least getting close to some of these laws in South Dakota. So what we're trying to do is try and match some of this and improve the situation for the dealers. There's about 500 or 600 dealers around the state of Minnesota that currently have these type of relationships, and often the relationships are pretty much one way. The local dealers want to sell the product, but what will happen is the manufacturers will come in and they'll say, hey, you know, for example, like right now, granted there's a lot of snow outside, but a couple weeks ago they would have said, hey, you need to buy a couple hundred more sleds. So what happens is they need to buy them, or they'll have the threat of the dealer being pulled from them. So that's a little bit of a concern. So we're trying to do that and trying to work on the relationships. Right now, they're often under a one-year arrangement, and it's quite a lengthy bill. The amendment that we offered pulls there was two parts. The first part was with the relationship, and the second part was a lot of titling parts, and we pulled that out for the most part, and there's still a little bit remaining, but I'm going to have Buzz and some testifiers talk to this bill. Mr. Anderson, sorry. Let's see, where else do I have to go here? You're going to hear some pretty compelling testimony from some of the dealers that are currently, you know, living this and trying to sell their products around the state. Again, there's quite a few of them. There's, you know, again, 500 and 600 of these. And they're trying to make a living out there out in Minnesota. And I think what I'd like to do now is to have Buzz Anderson. He's from the retailers. And if he could kind of go through the bill and explain it a little better. And then after that, we could have some testifiers come up and speak in favor, and I know there is some opposition, and I'd like to hear from them as well. So,
yep, we got a list here. Mr. Anderson, please identify yourself for the record, and feel free to take us through the bill as quickly as possible so we get everybody who's on both sides just to testify.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Buzz Anderson. I'm president of the Minnesota Retailers Association. I will try to be as brief as possible, and if you have specific questions, we can go back and look at something a little more closely. Why would we offer this bill? After all, we are a free market organization, as are our members. However, we do believe that there's a compelling public interest to make sure that there's a fair business relationship between dealers and manufacturers. We also think there's a compelling public interest to protect dealers from unfair treatment by manufacturers who inherently have superior economic power and superior bargaining power. And we think it's in a compelling public interest to provide them with a remedy if, in fact, they're taken advantage of. Now, the words I just used are out of the Wisconsin statute that provides protection to dealers. And it was pointed out to me by manufacturers this morning that our law is more extensive than Wisconsin. And that's true. We do have much more specificity in our law. But one of the things that the Wisconsin law has, when it talks about the fact that if you take away dealership, you gotta give them so much notice, you gotta make them whole, you gotta buy all their parts and so on. The Wisconsin law, again, is much less specific, but the Wisconsin law also says this chapter shall be liberally construed and applied to promote its underlying remedies, purposes, and policies. We want to take away any ambiguities, and so we've gotten very specific at this legislation to talk about what the obligations are if a manufacturer decides to close down a dealership or if the dealer decides to, in fact, close his dealership. Let me talk a little bit about the bill. The section one of the bill talks about the definitions, and it talks through what a motorsports dealer is, what a manufacturer is, what a dealership agreement is, what a termination or cancellation agreement is. Section 2 is a really important part because it talks about the fact that that a dealership, these 500 or 600 dealers in Minnesota, can't have their dealership taken away without cause. And unlike the Wisconsin law that has two very vague causes, we lay out eight very specific causes, one of which we've amended with the author's amendment. And let me just go through them. The manufacturer can terminate the dealership arrangement if there's been a major change in the business arrangement of the dealership without the consent of the manufacturer. I want to point out that the dealers in this case do not want to bring a retribution against manufacturers. What they want to do is create a level playing field so that there's a positive business relationship on both sides. I think you'll hear witnesses say today that they want to make sure that we have a strong manufacturing climate in Minnesota. They just want to make sure that manufacturers are also concerned about all those dealers around Minnesota as well. So that means that they can't sell their dealership without consent of the manufacturer. Now, the law or the proposal here also says they can't unreasonably withhold their consent, but still they are consulted and they have a major decision-making process as they go through that. Number two, they can terminate the dealership if there's been a bankruptcy filing. Three, there's been a change in the location of the dealer's principal place of business, again, without the consent of the manufacturer. Four, the dealer has defaulted on a mortgage with the manufacturer. Five, the dealer's failed to operate the dealership in a normal course of business for second consecutive days where they've abandoned the business. Six, the dealer's pleaded guilty or has been convicted of a felony. Here's the part that we amended because manufacturers said this morning, are you telling me that if a dealer commits a felony against a manufacturer, that they still have to buy the business? So what we're saying in the author's amendment is the obligation is not there for the manufacturer if, in fact, the dealer himself or herself commits a felony against the manufacturer. Seven, the dealership can be terminated if the dealer has engaged in conduct which is injurious to a dealer's customer or to the public welfare. Or eight, the dealer fails to meet reasonable market penetration requirements based on manufacturer's experience and other comparable marketing areas. Now, we're not saying the dealer or the manufacturers cannot set market penetration requirements. We just say they have to be reasonable. And I think you'll hear from our very compelling witnesses today that oftentimes manufacturers do set unrealistic market expectations. So what happens with this bill? Number one, we say that in subdivision two, if you're going to terminate a dealership, you have to give notice. You have to give them a 90-day notice. Once you've given them a notice about in writing about what's wrong with their dealership, they have 60 days in which to correct that deficiency. If the 60 days is if the dealer is not able to remedy the problem, then the dealership can be terminated, but the dealer is required then to pay the net cost of all unused outdoor sports equipment that's in new condition that's been purchased within the last 24 months. There's auto obligation. There's also an obligation in Subdivision 4 to purchase the repair parts. And there's a formula set on this bill for how they have to purchase the repair parts. Once the repair parts are obtained by the manufacturer, Subdivision 5 says they have to pay the dealer within 60 days. If they don't pay them, they have to pay the maximum interest in law on the amount that they owe the dealer. Subdivision 6 said that there's a notice of interest to return, or the dealer has to notify the manufacturer that they intend to return product once the manufacturer's dealership relationship has been terminated. Subdivision 7 gives manufacturers the right to do an inspection. Subdivision 8 says that there's payment or credit requirements, that if the manufacturer sends a credit list, payment for acceptable returns must accompany the credit list. Subdivision 9 says provisions of the contract can be supplemented. The dealer may elect to purchase either the dealer's contract remedy or the remedy provided in this section. 10, it says that if there's a death of a dealer, that the heirs have the right to repurchase the merchandise or to have the manufacturer purchase the equipment and parts and all the other provisions that are called for in the bill. Subdivision 11 says that failure to pay some specified on the cancellation of the contract liability, that is, in the event of the manufacturer's refusal to make payment, the dealer's heirs, the manufacturer, is liable to civil action. So that if the, in fact, the heirs are not paid for the business, that the heirs have a right to bring an action against the manufacturer. Subdivision 12 lays out exceptions. And section 3 talks about violations and what happens if there's a violation and what a violation is. The next section talks about warranties and the fact that warranties have to be paid to the manufacturer based on their average rate, market rate for doing warranty work, and they also have to be compensated for parts based on what the market is plus 15% recovery. So I guess what I'm telling you is that there's adjustments in here for the manufacturer. There's remedies for the manufacturer. And what we're, again, trying to do is to make sure that these dealers who are very, very interested in having a successful manufacturing climate have an opportunity to succeed without being taken advantage of by manufacturers. Again, we're trying to create a level playing field. If you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chair and Representative Lilly, I'd like to call two witnesses to the table, Bob Weir and Steve Vanderputty. Bob Weir is from Hutchinson, Minnesota, Yamaha Motorsports, and Steve Vanderputty is from Baxter, Brainerd area, and he's with Brothers Motorsports. And I've asked them to keep their testimony to 5 minutes, but I'm sure you might have questions for them.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Weir, welcome to the committee. If you'll just identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Mr. Vanderputty, welcome to the committee as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Bob Weir, and I'm from Hutchinson, Minnesota.
Steve Vanderputty from Brainerd, Minnesota.
Mr. Weir?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to address you today. My son and I own two motorsports dealerships and marine dealerships in Minnesota. We carry 6 boat lines and 2 motorsports lines. We own 2 stores. We have approximately $3.5 to $4 million in gross sales per year and pay the wages for 15 employees per year. We have been in business for approximately 11 years. Currently, I don't think the manufacturers can categorize us as being just another disgruntled, non-performing dealer. We are looking for fairness in business and parity with the manufacturers, no free ride. Although we have had a good relationship with the manufacturers over the years, our partnership has not been equal. Wisconsin dealers have this parity with manufacturers. Iowa dealers have this parity. South Dakota dealers have this parity. In fact, our own Minnesota legislature gave similar protection to car dealers and implement dealers. This protection is long overdue for the motorsports marine dealers in Minnesota, and too late for many. Without any dealer protection, the Minnesota dealers have become the warehouse for the manufacturers and indirectly their capital reserves. They are driving our businesses more than we are. And unfortunately, at the expense of the dealers, their families, their employees. The short and long-term capital investment in these businesses is considerable, with personal guarantees required. If the manufacturers sincerely hold dealers as true partners, why don't they have long-term dealer agreements instead of annual contracts? You cannot build a dealership in 1 year. You cannot train technicians in 1 year. It takes up to 5 years. You cannot recover your investments in 1 year. The overhead is way too great. I believe the manufacturers have good people working for them, but it is too easy to exploit dealers in Minnesota. This needs to change. Please help us, like you did for the car dealers, like you did for the implement dealers. Another dealer wrote with me to the meeting, and he's in the audience and will address questions as well. He is a competitor of mine. We rode together, attesting to the importance of this bill to all dealers. He lost his retirement savings and is still paying today for his past relationship with a motorsports manufacturer. And unbelievable as it may sound, he might have to go through it again as a marine dealer. As his competitor, for years, I truly believe his situation had nothing to do with his management abilities. Basically, he was forced out of business because he couldn't afford to do business the way the manufacturers are allowed to do business in the state of Minnesota. Last year, our dealership was ranked 3rd in Minnesota and 5th out of 44 Minnesota and Wisconsin combined dealers in the sale of a manufacturer's watercraft. In light of this ranking, all of our recent reviews from the manufacturer state that we are contractually non-compliant and are not meeting our market share numbers. This year, we ordered 110% of what the manufacturer said we should order. However, the manufacturer physically cannot build enough units and therefore canceled several of our units, in addition to moving back several other units. Although the manufacturer cannot produce these units, it is beyond belief and rather hypocritical that our unit target has not changed. Still, our reviews reflect that we are non-compliant in market share, yet we are the third largest dealer in Minnesota. What's also interesting and a point of contention with us is that we are not evaluated by the demographics around the Hutchinson area, like most manufacturers do to us. But we are evaluated by the demographics of Minneapolis, which is 60 to 80 miles away from us. Also, it is interesting that we don't have a yearly signed agreement for 8 months now into the new season, yet we have product and units delivered. This is not unusual to sign yearly contracts that we may or may not see again. Contrary to belief, the manufacturers have terminated several dealers in the last 2 years, especially marine dealers. They don't call it termination. What they call it is the failure to renew. The message here is that motorsports and marine manufacturers can do pretty much whatever they want in the state of Minnesota. Hopefully this committee disagrees and passes this bill in committee. This bill is more crucial to pass this year because the motorsports and marine industry is currently down 35 to 40% in Minnesota. Many of the dealers' reserves are gone, with inventory levels extremely high. Most dealers' credit lines are maxed, and yet the manufacturers are asking dealers to bail them out. In some cases, there is enough product built that if all the manufacturers would stop building today, it would take 2 years, mind you, to clean out the pipeline. The dealers didn't create that situation. The manufacturers did. All the manufacturers have moved up unit deliveries to dealers to help manufacturers' cash flow. They moved up their deliveries to help their cash flow. This has the opposite effect on the dealers. Their flooring limits can't handle the unscheduled deliveries, and the resulting high interest we pay to the manufacturers is killing us. We want our management skills and hard work to determine our financial future, not the manager, the manufacturer's management style. In closing, remember, the precedence has already been set by the legislature. The car dealers and implement dealers in Minnesota already have this protection. I believe in equality and spent 20 years in the military supporting that philosophy. If it's right for them, how can it not be right for us? All the surrounding states have made the call already, providing protection for the motorsports and marine dealers. Hopefully today will be the first step forward for Minnesota dealer protection. I respectfully thank you for the time. Does anybody have any questions?
And I think, Mr. Weir, we're going to hold questions until we complete all the testimony. Mr. Vandiputty, the only thing I'd ask in light of the time is if you have things in addition to what Mr. Weir, we certainly want to hear them, but it's probably
Mr.
not necessary
Chairman
to repeat.
And committee members, thank you for taking the time to hear me today. I'm not going to take hardly any of your time. I'm here more to answer questions and assure you that the manufacturer is going to tell you they've never terminated anyone because they didn't order enough product. I'm here to tell you that they have. They just call it non-renewal of a dealer agreement. They're also going to tell you, why did you enter into this contract in the beginning when you knew it was a one-year dealer agreement? What's changed is the business climate, the amount of investment they've asked us to make, the amount of products they make. It's time that we get a franchise. I'm not here because I'm vindictive against the manufacturer. I support the industry. I love the industry. I got into it because it's my passion. All I want is to be treated fairly. I want to be treated like the other franchise companies in this state, whether it be a car dealer or a motorcycle dealer. That's all I'm asking. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Vandiputty. Thank you, Mr. Weir. Anyone else, Representative Lilly, I don't see anybody else on the list in terms of support, but I see a couple folks in terms of opposition.
Mr. Chair and members, we have more if there's other additional questions, but we're good to go, sir.
All righty. Thank you, Representative Lilly. With that, I will turn to Rick Stocky from Articat, Mike Mitchell, and Keith Carpenter from Polaris and Genmar, respectively. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, welcome to the committee. If you could just identify who you are and proceed with the testimony.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Rick Silkey with Arctic Cat.
Michael Mitchell from Polaris.
Keith Carpenter from Denmark.
Mr. Silkey.
Good afternoon. My name is Rick Silkey, and I'm a regional sales manager for Arctic Cat Sales. Arctic Cat is based in Thief River Falls with additional manufacturing facility in St. Cloud. This legislation impacts not only Arctic Cat, but also would impact all manufacturers of outdoor motorsports equipment. It is especially troubling for us as a Minnesota-based manufacturer. Our state is home to nationally and internationally significant manufacturers of boats, snowmobiles, ATVs, utility vehicles, and motorcycles. We employ thousands of people throughout greater Minnesota and support suppliers and vendors in the state who employ thousands more. These are challenging times, not only for our dealers, but for our other partners and ourselves, as several of us have recently had to go through the pain of layoffs. My company, Arctic Cat, employs 1,500 people throughout Minnesota. We make snowmobiles, ATVs, and utility vehicles. Arctic Cat's products are distributed throughout the United States by over 1,100 independent dealers. These dealers usually carry more than just ATVs or snowmobiles. They can be lumber yards, hardware stores, or lawn and garden shops. Many of these dealers carry multiple competing brands of products, including products from companies like Honda, Yamaha, Kawasaki, and Suzuki. Our ATV business currently faces increasing competition from companies located in Taiwan, China, and other Asian countries, most of which don't conform or certify to minimal safety requirements. The snowmobile and ATV markets are highly competitive based on a number of factors, including brand loyalty, price, and distribution. As a result, our dealer network and relationships with our dealers are of critical importance to the ongoing well-being of the company. Dealers are the only way we retail our product. Because our products require pre-delivery setup and some after-sale service, we need a strong dealer between us as a manufacturer and the consumer. Financially strong, profitable, good business people will run their businesses in a way that gives consumers the shopping and service experience they are looking for, and consequently are the best way for us to get our products to consumers. The better our dealers are and the better our relationship is with those dealers, the better our service, the better service that we can offer to the customer. Each year, we enter into written agreements with our dealers. Under those agreements, Arctocat generally is obligated to give each dealer written notice of performance issues and 60 days in which to correct those issues. We also make considerable investments in our dealers. With our corporate advertising program, we pay up to 60% of the dealer's advertising costs. With our floor plan assistance program, we pay most of the bank interest for our products, which the dealers own. With our world-class store program, we pay a portion of the dealer's store remodeling cost. Additionally, when it comes to the dealer's signs, each dealer is eligible for a reimbursement of up to 50% of the cost for a sign under the cooperative advertising program. Upon termination by either the dealer or Arctocat, Arctocat pays for the remaining $200, takes the sign face, and the dealer gets to keep the sign box to use with other signs if it so chooses. In the last 10 years, Arctocat has not terminated or not renewed a single Minnesota dealer. Throughout the country, we have rarely terminated a dealer. Yet through our existing dealer agreement, a dealer can cease doing business with us for any reason or no reason and need to give us only 30 days notice. On the other hand, we can't do the same thing without significant financial consequences. When it comes to product orders, dealers make their own decisions about the size of the order that they want to make. There are no threats. We recognize that some dealers may have inventory issues, especially on the snowmobile side of our business. During the last 10 years, we have had one normal snowfall across North America, and the industry has been adjusting to the resulting market realities. Like most industries, dealers order their products months before retail sales begin. Like most industries, sales forecasts are made that may or may not turn out to be accurate. But forced repurchase of old inventory by government intervention is wrong. I've had personal experience with mandatory repurchase requirements. In those situations, I have seen dealers abuse the system and return worn and used items, such as used ATV tires. We recently had a return of ATVs where every ATV was missing its battery and some other parts. The business cost to Arctocat to deal with such conduct is huge. Such a provision in law will be harmful to Arctocat, its employees, and its shareholders. We design, manufacture, and nationally advertise our products, and then totally rely on our dealers to sell at retail. If they do a poor job, we are out of business. The ability to have a strong and responsive dealer system is critical to meet the needs of our customers. When you think about it, manufacturers are held hostage to the performance of our dealers. If our dealers don't perform, we can't sell our product to the consumer. We have no alternative way of selling to the customer. We know that the overall satisfaction with our product and the customer's intent to repurchase is directly tied to the experience the customer has at the dealership. We believe these types of laws get in the way of good business relationships between the dealers and manufacturers, and we respectfully ask that you vote against HF 413. This vote is important for Minnesota jobs, Minnesota shareholders, and Minnesota outdoor enthusiasts who rely on Arctocat products and good Arctocat dealers for service. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stokey. Mr. Mitchell, I'm going to tell you the same thing I told Vandiputty over there. If there's anything that you can leave out as repetitive, we certainly want to hear any new arguments that you have, and I welcome you to do that.
Definitely do that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Mike Mitchell. I work at Polaris Industries, headquartered in Medina, Minnesota. Polaris manufactures ATVs, snowmobiles, utility vehicles, motorcycles. We employ 3,500 people and approximately 2,000 in Minnesota. At Polaris, I spend a substantial amount of my time addressing issues relating to the dealer network in both a business and a legal capacity. Recent years have brought tougher times for dealers and manufacturers alike. The snowmobile industry has suffered due to sub-average snowfall, and ATV sales have declined in recent years after many years of double-digit growth. Accordingly, we want to tell you why we oppose legislation that will have the effect of increasing the cost of doing business to Minnesota manufacturers, will hinder the efforts of good Minnesota dealers, and ultimately will harm Minnesota consumers. Dealer relationships are vital to power sports manufacturing. Manufacturers rely on dealers to sell their products, and we need them to succeed. Not surprisingly, all manufacturers compete hard for good dealers, and we work hard to help them succeed. It may be helpful to describe how the dealer-manufacturer relationship works in our industry. Polaris dealers enter into one-year dealer agreements. Power sports dealers do not pay any premium or franchise fee to become a power sports dealer. Power sports dealers represent multiple manufacturers at the same location, including manufacturers inside and outside of the power sports industry. When working with dealers on orders, each individual dealer's circumstances are looked at, and the dealer is given options that are intended to be fair and reasonable for that dealer based on their own market and their respective inventory levels. That being said, no one can perfectly predict the market, and thus when there are things that affect the market, like the lack of snow this year in the Midwest, with lots of snow in the mountains, inventory levels can be affected both positively and negatively. When this happens, a variety of actions are taken by manufacturers, including adjustments to orders, shipments, and retail support. It's a normal part of the business cycle, and it is a manufacturer's problem as well. The Polaris dealer agreement gives dealers the flexibility to get out of the relationship whenever they want, simply by providing notice. Polaris, on the other hand, cannot terminate its agreement without cost. At the end of the one-year contract term, both parties have the flexibility to decide whether to renew the agreement. This flexibility is good for both parties as circumstances can and do change. Even with this flexibility, however, the fact is that both sides usually do renew the contract and dealers remain dealers for many years. The reason for this is clear. Non-renewals in Minnesota are very rare because it's neither easy nor desirable to cancel the dealer. It leaves holes in the marketplace, and it is disruptive to consumers. Polaris, for example, has not non-renewed any dealers in Minnesota since 2004. Moreover, terminations of dealerships in Minnesota have been very infrequent, with most terminations resulting from dealers self-terminating rather than any action taken by Polaris. Nonetheless, there are times when non-renewal is warranted, where damage is caused by a dealer who is either unwilling to promote a brand or to serve customers well. No matter how well-intended, House File 413 would radically undermine the way manufacturers and dealers currently work together in Minnesota. Whereas now the manufacturers and dealers share opportunity and risk, this bill shifts an enormous amount of risk and cost onto the manufacturers. First, the bill is not tailored to protect only mistreated dealers. For example, the bill's mandatory inventory buyback provision in Section 2, turns manufacturers into insurance companies. Manufacturers must repurchase inventory whether the dealer decides to walk away on its own or whether the dealer has committed an egregious violation of the dealer agreement, whether it's fraud against the consumer or a felony using its dealership. Second, since good dealers are in such high demand, laws of this nature inevitably end up protecting the dealers that are the marginal performers or worse. Consumers and other dealers are harmed as poorly performing dealers remain in the network and continue to provide substandard service and poor choices to consumers. Third, the bill has vague language that will only increase litigation and create uncertainty. One example is a prohibition against any substantial change to the competitive circumstances of a dealer. This is in Section 1, Subdivision 2. This language is a well-known source of litigation and uncertainty where it has been employed in Wisconsin and elsewhere because it provides no guidance as to its meaning, its scope, or its application. As a result, a manufacturer's ability to compete is hindered as virtually any business decision can be challenged by a dealer. Similarly, in some other states, manufacturers have not been able to offer excellent incentive programs for dealers that almost all dealers wanted because certain non-performing dealers did not take advantage of the program. We understand this bill comes about as out of the anxiety being felt by power sports dealers due to the current state of the industry. We feel it too. We've dealt with two layoffs in the past 2 years or so, but this law will not address those problems. Rather, it will create more cost and more problems for Minnesota manufacturers, Minnesota dealers, and Minnesota consumers. You've heard complaints from a few dealers today. However, thoughtless terminations of good dealers simply do not happen because they did not make good business sense. For these reasons, House File 413 is an unnecessary and harmful step in regulating relationships between power sports dealers and manufacturers. Polaris Industries hopes you'll look skeptically at this bill, and we urge you not to pass House File 413. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Ms. Carpenter.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Keith Carpenter, and I'm Assistant General Counsel of Genmar Holdings, Inc., which is located in Minneapolis. I appreciate the opportunity to provide our views on this legislation. Genmar is the world's largest privately held boat manufacturer with over 4,500 employees worldwide, including approximately 825 employees here in Minnesota. We currently have 13 different boat brands, which are manufactured at 9 different manufacturing facilities, including one facility in Little Falls, Minnesota. Our products are sold through a worldwide distribution network of over 1,200 dealers, 32 of those located here in Minnesota. Recreational boating is an immensely popular activity in America, and especially here in Minnesota. Sales of boats, however, have been flat or even decreased over the past years. As a discretionary item, boats often compete directly with other recreational pastimes for the consumer's dollar. If we don't deliver good value and an experience sought by the public, our customers will move elsewhere. My primary purpose today is to explain why this legislation would harm efforts to expand manufacturing employment and constrain Minnesota manufacturers and dealers who wish to expand. This legislation dulls the benefits of accountability and gives dealers unreasonable protection from market forces and poor performance. It will, in effect, prop up marine dealers who provide inadequate customer service. This bill's protections will harm efforts of ambitious dealers and manufacturers to provide Minnesota boaters with an excellent customer service experience that one generally expects when purchasing an item of this value. This bill, although well-intended, I'm sure, will only increase this problem by essentially granting a dealer the rights of a franchisee without the dealer having to be accountable. The protections offered in House File 413 are of little use to well-run dealerships, but this legislation allows poorly performing dealers to hide behind such terms as substantial compliance, cause, and a mandatory repurchase of old inventory. That, in a nutshell, is what is so problematic about this legislation. It reduces a dealer's accountability and assumes that the manufacturers do not face substantial risk in the marketplace. If our retail customers are not happy with their experience with their dealer, they will go elsewhere the next time, or they will leave boating completely. Do we occasionally feel the need to terminate or non-renew our relationship with the dealer? Absolutely. These tough decisions are, however, always based on what's happening in the marketplace. It costs us money every time we have to alter our distribution network. We don't make these decisions willy-nilly. But we are running a business, and if any of our dealers are not performing satisfactorily, then we need the flexibility to make a change. We owe this to our shareholders, our employees, and most importantly, our customers. As you may be aware, in 2005, the National Marine Manufacturers Association, in conjunction with 20 boat dealers, formed a high-profile task force to analyze these dealer contract issues in the marine industry. Roger Cloutier, the president of Genmar, was a member of this task force and helped to draft suggested language that all marine manufacturers were asked to consider incorporating into their dealer agreements. The recommendations included provisions for a rolling 3-year term, exclusive territories, inventory buyback obligations, and succession planning, to name a few. Additionally, these recommendations included increased obligations on the dealer relative to customer service, facilities, market share, and the like. All of our brands at Genmar have adopted what we call the 3-year agreement. The truth of the matter is, our dealers don't want it wrong. They like the way things are operating. They do not want the increased accountability that goes along with the new agreement. I respectfully ask that you oppose House File 413. It's the right thing to do for Minnesota boaters, for well-run dealerships, and manufacturers who provide the jobs and income that is so vital to the Minnesota economy.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. Representative Lilly, I'll ask generally, is there anyone else that desires to be heard with regard to this bill? Okay, Representative Lilly, you want a couple of final comments, then we'll see what questions or comments members of the committee may have.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to invite Buzz up, Mr. Anderson, to respond to some of the questions real quickly. And
sure.
Maybe slide a chair in here.
Just briefly, Mr. Anderson, we've still got 3 bills left yet that we're going to try to get through, and I want to certainly take action with regard to those.
Mr. Chair, I'll be as brief as I can, and I I want you to know that, once again, the dealers do want a strong manufacturing climate in Minnesota. Bar none. I mean, they absolutely do. On the other hand, dealers also do not want to have bad dealers. And that's part of the reason for the bill, too. We want these folks to be able to have the ability to take bad dealers out of business, because it does them no good if bad dealers are selling a brand that they're also selling, because it hurts their ability to then sell that brand. They degraded the value of that brand. I might also want to say that, well, I maybe should just stop there because I know we're short on time, but I would like to have the witnesses have an opportunity to respond to some of these comments made, because they're out in their field, but I also understand we're short on time, so I'll defer to you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. By the way, I'd commend you. It looks like you have been trying to work together. I know that there's one with regard to the, in terms of the author's amendment, one takes into account if there's deliberate fraud by a dealer, that certainly preserves the right. And then there's also, I know that there was a huge issue with regard to the titling stuff, and it looks like you're trying to move the right direction with regard to that. Are there comments, questions, Representative Paulson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to follow this a little bit. It's a little confusing, but it seems to me, listening to the manufacturers and the dealers, that there's a little bit of economic warfare going on between the two sides, and obviously you're both dependent on each other to be successful, as you both mentioned, and it sounds like there have been some tough times, obviously, with the snowfall season and sales going down. That obviously affects the manufacturers, it affects the dealers. I'm just kind of curious, though, you know, we haven't talked too much about the consumer. What happens with the consumer in this equation? If there are dealers that are not, you know, fulfilling their warranties properly, that are not, you know, being good customer service providers, I worry about the increased litigation costs that could potentially impact and ultimately get passed on to the consumer. I'm just wondering, where's the consumer in this equation? If, you know, I understand the manufacturers may have a view on this, but Mr. Anderson, Representative Lilly, I mean, what might your viewpoint be on how does this help the consumer? Aside from the small business angle and the manufacturing.
Good question. Representative Lilly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Paulson. It's actually a very good thing for the consumer, I think, because what's going to happen is you're going to have dealers that are even more invested into their business and their community. Right now what happens is they can be, it's a year-by-year relationship. I mean, how can you really be certain that you're going to, yes, many of them do go on for year after year, but how can you be certain that your relationship's going to be there year after year? And just kind of going back to what the chair's statement, I very much appreciate the other side. They've been very good about working on this, and we've tried to compromise. There's the second section of this bill, you know, there actually produces income, so it's interesting with the titling aspects, and Senator Bach wants some of that money to go back into the trail sort of thing. So that's another way where you can help, you know, the community and the customers, so they have more places to use dirt bikes and ATVs out on the trails. Maybe Mr. Anderson has a better, more articulate answer to your question, but
Representative Paulson, does that suffice?
Mr. Chair, maybe I'm just curious. I mean, how much does a buyback cost? I mean, I guess one worry I have is if the dealer has a lot more leeway in terms of saying we want to get out of our agreement, we're going to have the manufacturer buy back all the inventory and everything, it seems to me that's a pretty significant cost. I mean, and that may come up. Maybe it wouldn't happen that often, but it seems to me that would be a pretty significant cost that could have an impact on consumer price. I'm guessing.
Mr. Anderson?
Let me answer that with a question. What's the cost of the dealer to invest in the requirements by the manufacturer? We're not just talking about additional property. We're talking about specifications on the showroom. We're talking about signage. We're talking about diagnostic equipment, tools, training for employees, and that's an investment that they continue to make, not to mention the inventory and the parts. This is a huge investment on their part. And when they make that investment year after year, they have to know that there's going to be something at the other end of that, so that they're not just taking that risk willy-nilly. They want to know that they're doing that for a reason. I might also say, and I just want to emphasize, it does the consumer no good to have bad dealers. We don't want bad dealers in the business. Part of what this bill will do is get the bad dealers out, and we want that to happen.
Mr. Anderson, Representative LaForest.
Mr. Chairman, I just have one question here, and I'm trying to reconcile the testimony that I've heard here. I believe Mr. Anderson and his folks used adjectives like many and significant in terms of non-renewals
and dealer foreclosures and the like, and yet I heard the manufacturers testify that there have been none or very few in the recent past. I don't know, Mr. Chairman, if we can reconcile statistics here. Perhaps so is Mr. Anderson here. How widespread is the problem here that is necessitating a pretty significant bill?
Let me ask it this way. Does anybody have the hard number? Rather than have you all give us...
I only know the number for our company.
I do not, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to know.
Mr. Carpenter, you're the only one with a hard number. What's your number for Genmar?
We, in the last 3 years, have lost two Minnesota dealers, one who filed bankruptcy, and one who voluntarily gave up the line. They no longer wanted to carry our product.
Mm-hmm. You guys know offhand?
Yes,
Mr. Mitchell?
In the last 3 years, we've lost nine dealers, five of which have self-turned, and four of which were a result of a non-renewal or a termination for losing the floor plan or for committing fraud.
Okay. Anybody else have hard numbers? Seth, Representative De La Forest,
yes,
that's what we got today.
Yep. I've got a hard number.
Vandiputty's one.
Right here.
All right, well, there's one sitting behind you, Mr. De La Forest.
I can give you one, probably more important.
Thank you. Representative Anseltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two quick, pretty simple questions, and brief responses are fine. First question is to the manufacturers. As someone who comes from greater Minnesota, of course, I'm always concerned about manufacturing jobs, even the non-union ones. Can you give me a number as to... will this bill, if it's passed, cause the elimination of any of the manufacturing jobs in your Minnesota operations?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's difficult to say that. What is certain that will happen with this bill is that it will increase costs across the board for consumers. We talked about dealers earlier today that talked about being on potentially the brink. A bill like this basically says, I don't have to work through the difficult time in the industry. I can leave, and the manufacturer will bail me out. The amount of the repurchase is going to vary from dealer to dealer, but it's substantial. And as we already mentioned before in earlier testimony, we've already had layoffs as a result of the current state of the industry.
Thank you, Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I have a little different swing on this. I just really see it as a pro jobs and a pro manufacturing. I'm excited for you guys. I think the dealers I've met with, they want to sell their products. They want to make money. They want to get out there and sell it, and they can do this on a long-term relationship. They're committed to, Minnesota products and these other sporting equipments. They want to be able to sell them. So I just see, yes, it's a little uncomfortable now, but I see it as being a real positive thing for the business partnership, if you will, ongoing and for. And I hope it adds to jobs in Minnesota, personally.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. You
thank you for
question,
that. I was just looking for a little clarity on the job side of this. And my second question is, I'd be real interested to know what position the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce has on this bill.
Has the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce weighed in?
Are they in the room?
Or did they run quickly away when they saw that that there might be some of their own?
Thank you.
I've got Representative Knuth and Representative Simpson. Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, a comment. I know you've talked a lot about your business climate as snowmobile manufacturers and the Global Warming Mitigation Act being heard right upstairs, if anyone's interested in testifying on that bill. But the question I had is just, do you have a little, just a short description of the size of the dealers you work with? Are they large companies, small companies? Do you work with individuals, people who have what number of stores and employees? I'm just
Mr. Short Chairman and Representative, it's going to vary across the board. You're going to have everything down to the small mom and pop up to the larger power store that represents multi-line, 6, 7, 8, 9 manufacturers, depending on what they do. So it's really going to vary across the board for us.
Governor.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's true. We have a whole array of dealers. We have a whole array of products we offer, anywhere from very small runabout type boats in the $15,000 to $20,000 range, all the way up to multi-million dollar yachts. So the level of sophistication of our dealers and the size of our dealership varies greatly, both based on the product they carry and the location that they're in. And just to go back to one other thing that another representative inquired about regarding the buyback, as a marine manufacturer, the price of our product is much larger than other power sports manufacturers. So when we have dealer turnover in any event, whether it's governed by a statute such as this or whether it's just a dealer leaving our marketplace or our family for whatever reason, it is a huge cost to us to switch dealers because we have to do something generally with that product. Whether we made the decision to make the move or whether the dealer did, that product goes somewhere else usually. And we have to assist in that, and that usually means us having to pay for part of that. It can be a big number. Thank you.
Mr. Stolke, anything you want to add to that?
No, only that I would concur. There are different size dealers for different markets that they serve, and they're across the board in size. And stuff. Okay.
Representative Knuth, any follow-up to that? Representative Simpson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if this is a question or a comment, maybe a question in the end. I've bought Polaris snowmobiles for 35 years from a dealer that's a postage stamp dealer. And he's had a good relationship, I know, with the company for many years. I also live in the town of New York Mill, so I've seen the Lund Boat Company grow, and I've seen the Lund Boat Company have its challenges the last few years with the downturn in the economy. They went from almost 600 employees down to about 350. So I think part of what we're hearing from the manufacturers and from the dealers is it is a challenging time right now with some of the market play. I guess the one thing that I'd like to know, is this a broad-based problem that's happening because of our Minnesota companies, or is this a problem that's happening with international companies that are coming into our marketplace? Because I think there's maybe two topics here, and I think that we're very fortunate in rural Minnesota to have these three players sitting at the table up here, because the amount of business that's created in rural Minnesota because of Polaris, Genmar, and Arctic Cat, the subsidiary businesses is just unbelievable. I have communities up and down Highway 10 that are manufacturing parts, painting parts, delivering product to all three of these companies that is just a tremendous part of our rural economy. So I think we want to make real sure about what we do. I'm not saying we can't help our dealers, but I think we have to be real careful what we do with our manufacturers because they really play a vital part of our rural economy.
And an excellent question, Representative Simpson, is... Representative Lilly or Mr. Anderson, are you in a position to answer whether the three gentlemen? Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and members, let me say, I'm happy these folks are in Minnesota. They're really important, really important, and they're really important to the dealers as well. But the dealers are also important to them. So the two dealers that spoke just laid off employees for the first time ever in their history. One's been in business for 45 years. It's the first year he's ever laid off people. And it's true of the other gentleman that spoke as well. So, I mean, everybody is going through this problem together. But imagine that you're a motorsports dealer, and you've been in business for 17 or 18 years, and the manufacturer comes to you and says, I want you to buy 150 more snowmobiles or ATVs. And you kind of go, I still got 50 or 60 left over from last year. Well, you either do this or you lose all your dealership programs. What are you supposed to do? Continue to put yourself in debt. I've got one gentleman who's sitting in the audience who lost all of his retirement and had to put a lien on his home in order to keep himself out of bankruptcy because of the demands made by the manufacturers. That's part of what we're trying to stop. We're trying to make sure that the dealers themselves also have some economic power so that they can be partners. We want the manufacturers to worry about the dealers. The dealers are certainly worried about the manufacturers, and what we're trying to do is level that playing field.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Carpenter, you had a comment?
Thank you, Mr.
And then
Chair.
We're going to have to...
If I could just respond to that, I think there's an important distinction that needs to be made. We as manufacturers, at least Genmar, we do not require our dealers to purchase any amount of product during a year. At the beginning of the year, we set a goal with each dealer, and that is a negotiated goal where we have buying periods and both we as the manufacturer and the dealer agree on what will be purchased during that manufacturing or during that buying period for the dealer to earn his program. If he doesn't buy that, that doesn't mean he loses his dealership. He is just buying that product at a different price. He is not terminated. He is not non-renewed. It just affects the price of the product. I think that's a very important distinction.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. With that, folks, we're already a little bit over our committee time. There's still a couple bills left up. Representative Lilly, I know you've got one more stop for sure to make in the Tax Committee. I commend you for your efforts thus far to work with the industry folks. I'm sure that that'll continue to occur before you get to the Tax Committee, where I get to see you again.
Okay.
With that, Representative Lilly renews his motion that the House file 413 be recommended passed and we refer to the Tax Committee. Is there further comments or questions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your comments this afternoon. We are going to depart from the order a little bit. Anytime we've got a non-member of this committee that's been waiting for a hearing, Representative Loeffler, is House File 111. Preventive health care promoted by requiring high deductible health plans used with HSAs to cover preventive care with no deductible is permitted by federal law. Chair will move House File 111 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. Recommended Representative Loeffler. We're already kind of over our time, and I know I've got some folks that are going to chew my rear end if we don't get them out of here relatively soon, but you were patient and kind enough to wait for us to finish up. And I'd like to get through 111 and 475 for you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I always appreciate a thoughtful time. Almost everyone knows, and I would like to move the DE3 amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Chair moves DE3. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? There you go.
Thank you very much. Almost everyone knows someone who's died too young from a disease that could have been successfully caught early and overcome, whether that's someone who had breast cancer, someone who had a heart attack in their 40s or early 50s. And I'm all about prevention, and we ought to help people identify their health risks and deal with them early. This bill is about saving lives while helping control health care costs. It ensures that persons with a health savings account will not only get the federal and state tax advantage, but they'll also have access to preventative care and life-saving early diagnostic tests. First, let me tell you what the bill applies to and what the impact would be. The minimum annual deductible for an HSA-eligible insurance plan is currently $1,100 for an individual with $5,500 per year maximum out-of-pocket cost. That's for an individual. And for a family, the minimum deductible is $2,200 with a maximum of $11,000. Those maximums do not include the premiums that you would pay every month for your coverage. They just tell you the point at which the insurance kicks in. Health savings accounts are a tax-advantaged way to save for the uncovered cost of a high-deductible health plan. They may or may not have an employer contribution. I think there's some confusion about that. Some employers step up and offer to match contributions or fully fund it, and some do not. The contribution to the HSA is not state or federally taxed, nor is the interest earned on that savings account taxed, and there's no tax on the withdrawal before age 65 if it's used for health purposes. So it's one of the best tax shelters you can find in today's market. After age 65, you can use your HSA remainder funds for whatever you want without penalty, and sometimes you see some of the marketing materials to emphasize that. This bill implements the federal option to require that the high deductible health plans paired with an HSA cover preventative care without a deductible. Preventative care is defined in the regulations. It's basically the routine care that's been well documented to prevent costly health problems or catch treatable diseases early, while treatment options are more affordable and successful. And the handout that's been going around has a list of those. It includes vaccinations, blood pressure tests, blood tests, diabetes and cholesterol screening, cancer screening such as mammograms and pap smears, well child checks, those sorts of things. If it's not covered until the deductible is met, we know that many will forgo recommended care. And I've had people call me who have these kind of policies who said they've had to have the discussion around the kitchen table where the husband says, you know, we've got that $5,000 deductible. Maybe you could skip the mammogram this year. And I don't think we should be having people who for economic reasons, choose a high deductible plan, forego needed care. Well, this limits the market choice. This is the area that you have expertise in, and I don't know how many health bills you've heard, so I'm just going to briefly dip through. The ERISA federal law right now limits the ability of states to regulate self-insured health plans. We have both large and small employers who have chosen to be self-insured, and this bill will not apply to them. So it won't apply to our large employers and those others that have chosen to be self-insured. Individuals can still choose to buy a high-deductible health plan that doesn't include preventative care, but they won't be able to have the tax advantages of the health savings account. This is a statement that if you're going to get the tax advantage and reduce the taxes coming into the state treasury, that we expect you to have a quality plan that covers preventative care. There remains, after this bill is enacted, plenty of choice and benefit options in our marketplace. This just says that we value preventative care and as state have chosen to emphasize prevention and take advantage of the federal option. We've all heard a lot about the need to control health care costs and the demand for more affordable coverage. And prevention is one of our best goals towards that. You may have noticed a Star Tribune headline. This is from January 18th. And it's screening tests given credit for decline in cancer deaths. And in Minnesota, there were 268 fewer cancer deaths in Minnesota in 2005 than 2004. We know that it pays. Colorectal cancer can be treated more than 90% of the time if detected early. Screening by a colonoscopy every 10 years costs about 55 cents per member per month, but detecting it and removing a precancerous polyp is about $1,100 compared to $58,000 if it goes to stage 4. Treating a precancerous cervical lesion found through a Pap test costs about $1,000 to $2,000 depending on the circumstances. If that same lesion is not detected and it becomes cancerous, it can cost as much as $33,000 to treat. While only 1% of the commercially insured population has cancer, cancer costs about 10% of an employer insurer's annual medical costs. Clearly, prevention and diagnosis pay for all involved. The cost is modest. The total cost of all recommended cancer screenings when averaged over an insured population is about $7.25 per member per month. A small investment to sit in avoiding higher costs while saving lives. But this is based on a 2002 study from the American Cancer Society. I suspect it's closer to $10 now, given inflation. We know that the people who buy these policies are most price sensitive. Part of the reason why they're willing to accept a 2 or 3 or 5 or larger deductible is because they're conscious about price. But there's a lot of ways to meet a particular price point, and some of you who have been on this committee for a long time know that. You can, instead of covering 100% of the ambulance coverage, you cover it 50%. Instead of having a $15 copay on a prescription, you have $16. I mean, if you are working towards a price point, there's a variety of ways that you can put together a policy to meet those needs. Health plans that do not cover insured prevention ended up shifting costs onto plans that do, because we know, particularly in the individual market, people switch from company to company from year to year. And if you happen to have avoided screening costs while you were in one plan and you end up in another plan, they're the ones who are going to pay for your expensive treatment. The health plans tell me that their small group plans cover prevention. This plan is to keep this the standard in Minnesota. The impact of this bill would be on the individual policy. If you only set aside $100 a month in a health savings plan, your tax savings alone would more than offset any of the increased costs with prevention. I've been working with the health plans, and the amendment that you just adopted clarifies that the scope and frequency of coverage is subject to what's written in the policy and evidence-based standards. They were concerned that the federal listing opened it up a little too wide, and this says that they're going to use the evidence-based standards, whether that's the U.S. Preventative Care Guidelines or they have suggested the locally developed ICSI guidelines. I'm committed to pursuing many creative approaches to making health care coverage affordable and accessible to all, but having people die early from health conditions that could have been treated cost-effectively early is not the way to lower health care costs. I know you're going to be hearing from some testifiers, and I'll welcome a chance to respond when they're done.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And they understand that if they testify against your bill, you're going back to the original language that they didn't like? So. All right, is there anyone that desires to be heard with respect to this?
Very good.
Mr. Bart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. There's a few of us. We'll come up together and try not to repeat each other since we're crunched for time right now. For the record, my name is Jeff Barsh. I'm the Director of Legislative Affairs for Health Partners. First, I do want to thank Representative Loeffler for her patience and her willingness to sit down with us on a number of occasions and try to resolve some of the issues that we've raised with her. I think her amendment is a fair attempt on her part to address some of those concerns, so we do appreciate that. That said, we just have a couple concerns that we haven't been able to resolve with her that I'll let my colleagues talk about more specifically, but those are twofold. One is the attempt to put a new definition of preventive care into the statute. Historically in Minnesota, we've used a definition in Minnesota rule. That definition applies to HMO policies. We think that's worked very well over the years. So that's one concern. The second would be the philosophical difference that Representative Loeffler and us may share about applying these criteria to all individual policies. And it's particularly the individual market whereby people are making those coverage decisions for themselves. They have the ability to look at whether or not they want to buy full coverage or not full coverage, and it is up to them to make those decisions. So there's just a philosophical difference we have with her about those issues. Again, some others will talk to that. But specifically, just a general question we have about the problem that this bill is trying to address. We absolutely share her belief and her passion about preventive care. I think the article she referenced is a good indication that Minnesota as a community has responded well and believes in preventive care, and we share that belief. However, we're not quite sure if there's an issue with our current definition of preventive care or if there is an issue, we haven't heard it, although we did hear some anecdotal evidence from Representative Loeffler, of people coming to us and saying their high deductible health plan or their HSA policy isn't covering preventive care like they thought they did. And with that, I'll stop and I'll let some others continue.
Okay. Who's ever up next? Just identify yourself.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Danette Coleman. I'm the Vice President of Public Policy and Government Relations for Medica. What I wanted to mention was one aspect of this that Mr. Barsh referred to, and that really is in this bill, line 2.6, that defines preventive care as having the meaning given in the IRC. And the concern with this particular is the Internal Revenue Code. It's a tax code, clearly, and what the intent of this was to create what's referred to as the safe harbor language that would allow a number of services to be considered preventive as far as getting the tax benefit for it. This was not created as a list of services that should be considered preventive services, rather a list of things that could be considered preventive services. So the concern with this bill as this amendment is drafted is that we're actually going to be significantly expanding the definition of preventive care in Minnesota. As Mr. Barsh referenced, we have in Minnesota Rules 4685.0100, we define preventive care, and that has worked for years and years in Minnesota under the HMO statute. And it would be preferable to us to reference that rule under the high deductible section of law. We share Representative Loeffler's concern about preventive care and the value of preventive care, but the other concern with the with using the Internal Revenue Code, that's a moving, changing document, and any time that they would make a change to include something else in that definition, that would automatically, without any check by this body or the Department of Health, become a new mandate under preventive care. And there are some things in that list that, although we cover, we don't cover it as preventive care. So for an example of that, smoking cessation programs. We cover those services, but they're not necessarily under the preventive section of our contracts. And I know, just finally, I'll just say that I know that Representative Loeffler has talked about a desire to have a list of services that are considered preventive. And the concern with putting a list or referring to a list anywhere in statute is that There are many things in our contracts we provide coverage for, but we don't list every service under that. For example, our contract that we provide coverage for inpatient hospital, we don't list every potential service that you could receive inpatient. And if our contracts were that descriptive, even fewer people than currently read them now would be reading them if they were that long. So I'll end there and let others comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Coleman. Mr. Stahlberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm Phil Stahlberger with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. I won't repeat what the previous testifiers have said. Obviously, we do support prevention. We support the notion of more people getting insurance as well. And I think that's a lot of discussion has been around the past couple of months, is getting more people with some type of coverage. HSAs have been around since the 1990s, since the Clinton administration. They're gaining popularity. We're seeing a lot more people having interest in them. Having said that, I'm just going to provide just some numbers as far as our own numbers specifically. We have roughly 200,000 enrollees in an HSA product. 60% of them are individual policyholders. They have the option to purchase preventative coverage or not. Only 20% of those individuals purchase something without preventative coverage. And I think, as Representative Loeffler mentioned, there are groups of people out there that are very price sensitive to premiums. Whether it's 1%, 2%, 10%, any small increase does affect certain buyers. And it is those individuals I think we're all trying to get at, which is that 7% uninsured rate that we keep talking about. They're tough individuals to insure. As we move through the legislative session this year, we prefer to talk about let's find insurance for some, that 7%, rather than mandate exactly every type of coverage that needs to be required for every policyholder currently. Again, while the costs are minimal, we do support product option, product choice in the marketplace. Some folks are buying it, some are not. Those are just some of my quick and fast figures, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Griffin for further testimony.
Griffin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm representing Preferred One Health Plan. Mr. Chairman, members, at the risk of incurring the wrath of the chair, I'm going to repeat what my colleagues have said. We have a very small health plan. There are 400 lives currently in our individual product, which we just launched in September. We think that those people have the ability to make up their minds when they're buying an HSA as to whether or not they want to purchase preventive care or whether they want to put their money into an HSA and make the decision to pay for their preventive care outside of the policy on their own. We think that people can make those decisions, and they're quite capable of doing it without the state stepping in and telling them what they have to do. We are very supportive of preventive care. We, along with the other plans, are in the process of working on mailings, setting up our websites to get information to people about what they should do with preventive care, working with our providers to make sure that they actually go through the system that we've set up with the Medical Association called Minnesota Community Measurement to make sure that we get people treated the way they should be treated. But, Mr. Chairman, this does have an impact on the premium. We believe that, unlike Representative Loeffler, we're putting those premiums in a place where people can buy them and afford them, and to add this to it will make it less affordable for people. We would simply point out that we are a very small plan. I like to say we're the light, nimble chimpanzee that's competing with the big 800-pound gorillas, and we believe that this flies in the face of us trying to have the flexibility we need to sell product. We would respectfully request, in spite of the fact that we continue to work with Representative Loeffler on this, that you not pass the amendment and not pass the bill today. We appreciate your time and thoughtfulness in this effort.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin, and I now see you in a whole new light
as you
hop down the hall. Representative Loeffler, you want to reserve a minute or two for... I'm sorry, Mr. Hickey, I saw you on the list, and I just thought you didn't want to be surrounded by the gorillas and chimpanzees or something, but welcome to the committee.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. We're the state's largest business group in terms of entities, with about 15,000 statewide.
And Mr. Hickey, can I interrupt you for just a moment? Yes. For those folks that are here awaiting the 512 gift card bill, I'm unilaterally going to move that to Thursday. I apologize for doing so, but I do want to get members of the committee out of here in about the next 7 minutes. So we're going to try to get this bill done. Representative Loeffler's got one other that it doesn't appear to be anybody testifying on, but I didn't want to have folks feeling like they needed to stick around for that gift card bill. We'll do that first up on Thursday. I apologize. Mr. Hickey, please continue.
Certainly. We represent about 15,000 members statewide and have a significant member base in every district. I guess my testimony will be different in one respect. I'm the only one up here today who represents people who are trying to provide health insurance to their employees and are very cost conscious and concerned about cost. I think two things that are concerning about the bill, and I don't want to be overly redundant, but first of all, we are setting a new definition for preventive care in the group market. And Minnesota, I don't know how unique we are, but I thought it was unique when I first learned that all the insurers were providing preventive care in a group market. So people who were trying to make this transition to HSAs weren't going to have this problem to worry about whether they're going to have preventive care or not. So Minnesota may be unique in that category, but our current law is working. It's working for employers, and we don't need to change that in a way that's going to increase costs, and that's our concern. We're going to change the standard, and I think that we heard how the federal standard could change, be less dependable, and could also increase cost with the way it may change over time. The second issue here is what we're doing with the individual market where people don't, not everyone does have preventive care. And clearly we should just leave this choice to people who are trying to provide health care for themselves and trying to sort out these decisions. My guess is for the very young people, people we'd like to see get acquire health care in their 20s and 30s, they probably could get by just fine without preventive care. I do know older people do purchase it. But let's leave the choice to those consumers in that market and not raise costs there. So that's the concern that this bill is going to, like a lot of other things we've seen here today, we're seeing here this session, this is going to increase health insurance costs. Our HSA law is working fine, and we'd urge you to oppose this this amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Representative Loeffler?
Thanks for the time.
Thank you, members. I'll try and briefly respond to some of the issues that have been raised.
Well, whatever time you use is coming out of House File 475, which is
that's
your bill next.
So fast.
Feel free.
First of all, this is a unique blending, and it's not our design. It's the federal government's design to mix together tax policy and health insurance policy. And so we have a blended vehicle. And in order to get the tax advantage, we have the option to make sure that what you get to get that tax benefit is a quality product. When we adopted federal conformity with the HSA, and I don't have any problem with us having moved that direction, it cost our state treasury $10 million, and it's projected to go up. I don't know what the projections are this biennium. So we as a state are already investing in the health care of every individual who chooses to go to use this product to a cost of billions of dollars. As Phil Stahlbrenner from Prosper Shield spoke, the public has voted, even the individual buyers, and that only 20% have chosen to go without preventative coverage. And I've talked to insurance agents, and the main reason they would choose that is for cost considerations, which, as I noted before, can be handled in a variety of different ways in terms of changing other copayments and deductibles. There are the ability of people to make up their own minds is still there. They can still buy an individual policy with a high deductible plan and not have any preventative coverage. The only thing that's different is they don't get the tax advantages for that money that they set aside in a health savings account. I think it's actually good to create a common floor and that people compete on cost and quality and have a standard floor. The definition is the federal IRS definition. It is one that I don't think expands anything that we have, and that's why I put in the amendment that makes it clear that the scope and the frequency is going to be defined in the policy by the health insurance plan. The only difference is that it is taking the IRS permissible things. We had to make changes in our insurance mandate, you might recall, a couple of years ago, just to be able to offer these kind of products in the Minnesota market. And I think staying with a federal definition, I continue to challenge the industry to point out exactly what it is in the federal definition that isn't covered by our current understandings, and I must say I have not been able to discern that.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Are there questions, concerns? If not, okay. Representative Paulson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And aside, without getting into the policy discussion, I know over the issue, because I think health care had a pretty spirited discussion from what I understand on the bill. But if I understand now, the amendment that was put on with the delete all, if you participate in the preventative care side, you get the tax deductibility. If you don't participate, then you don't get the deductibility. Is that the genesis of it, Representative Loeffler? Just
Mr.
kind of follow
Chairman,
the tax deductibility.
That's correct. You'd still be able to buy a policy without the preventative care coverage. It's just that to meet the federal standard, take the federal option related to the health savings account and get the tax deductibility, we would say you'd have to take the prevention option.
Representative Paul. Mr. Chair, right now the motion is to send the bill where?
This would go to the general register.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I'll just amend the motion. Just because of the delete all amendment, I'll just amend the motion to re-refer the bill to the tax committee. I mean, not getting into the policy issue of the discussion here, but just because of the delete all amendment that was put on. I mean, I remember when the HSA bill was initially put in the law, it was carried in the tax bill. It had a fiscal note, and there's going to be some, I mean, I would think that there's going to be some impact potentially with, you know, lines 1.13 as mentioned in the amendment, so. Not to settle the bill, I'm just referencing just the fact that it
was the deductibility. Representative Laffer?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Paulson, actually the amendment didn't change anything about its tax consequences. It just defines more clearly in our insurance statutes what qualifies taking that federal option. It doesn't, I don't think, influence the fiscal note within the tax bill. It just says what is going to be covered. Perhaps Mr. Pender could qualify that, you know, explain that more clearly than I can, but that's my understanding.
Ms. Pender, do you have anything to add with respect to that?
Mr. Chair and members, not really. If you look at the lines there, 1.1, 1.12 and 1.13, they simply say that this bill requires coverage of preventive care, but it doesn't require coverage of preventive care that would disqualify the high deductible health plan for treatment with an HSA. So it's a reference to the federal tax law for that purpose.
Representative Paulson, do you find that satisfactory? My understanding of it, and I looked at it when it was the original House File 111, is that what Representative Loeffler indicated is in fact the case, that it's always been the intent. This does bring greater clarity to it. I don't believe that it changes, I know that it doesn't change HSAs at all, but at the same time I'm also very respectful of the committee process, and I don't want to get to the floor and have folks pop up and say, well, you jerks, you shouldn't have, you know, ought to go wherever. So I'll leave it in your hands.
And Mr. Chair, maybe I'll withdraw my motion right now, but if you could at least talk to Chair Lincheski, I think that would be helpful. Again, I just know the HSA provision was carried in the tax bill initially.
No, that's an excellent point, and I'll make a point, and I'm sure Representative Loeffler will visit with her as well to make sure that there's comfort there.
And Mr. Chairman, to that point, it's, I think, important to realize that the majority of people covered by this are in the small group market anyhow, and this doesn't apply because they're already covering that. It's the only people impacted are the 20% of the individual buyers, which is I don't know the exact numbers, but a pretty tiny part because most people are in group plans.
Okay. Anything further? Representative Poodles?
I was going to not say anything about young people and their lack of preventative care, myself included, until I recently got better health care, until Mr. Hickey said people in their 20s and 30s don't necessarily need preventative care, and I very much disagree with him, and thank you, Representative Loeffler, for encouraging preventative care, particularly among young people.
Thank you, Representative Knuth. Anything further? Seeing none, Chair renews his motion that House File 111 be recommended pass and referred to the general register. Seeing, unless there's anything further, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. You now have negative 2 minutes to present House File 475. I visited briefly with Representative Zellers. It doesn't sound like it's controversial. Is there anyone here that desires to be heard with respect to House File 475? Chair will move House File 475 be recommended to pass. Is it going anywhere else, Representative Loeffler? Recommended to pass and move to the floor. Do you have a brief presentation with regard to 475, Representative Loeffler?
Mr. Chairman, this is one that the insurance industry is much happier about. They're currently sending 4,000, just one company is sending 4,000 notices a year to college students to have them verify that they are full-time post-secondary students. We had testimony in the Human Services Committee that it demonstrated why you need this. One a constituent of Mary Ellen Otremba fell and broke her leg while she is a nursing student. She had to drop her practical classes, and at the time when she most needed health care to fix that broken leg, she no longer qualified for it.
Thank you,
Representative. It doesn't work for internships and other interruptions.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Unless there's questions or concerns for Representative Loeffler, Representative Zellers?
And I didn't have it, but Representative Loeffler, isn't that already covered under current law? If she broke her leg, it's a disability. So isn't that technically covered under law then?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Zellers, I'm not an expert on the definition of disability and whether it's a temporary thing. The situation that we also run into, and it perhaps it's more frequent, is the person who right now to get a job, you have to almost have an internship as part of your higher education experience, and you typically drop down to 4 or 5 credits for that. And so we have people in and out of coverage. And it's a lot of administration. I'd rather put my money into health coverage than administration.
Thank you. Representative Zellers, Chair renews his motion that House File 475 be recommended pass and refer to the General Register. Further comments or questions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
That motion carries. With that, folks, we stand adjourned.